When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Green from Fontaines DC, and this is the LSQ podcast.
What's up? It's Jenny LSQ. Thanks for pressing play on episode 71 of LSQ, wherein my guest is Green Chatton from Fontaines DC, a band I fucking love. And in case you haven't heard, the Irish post-punk band has just announced a new album, their third studio LP, which is called Skinty Fia, coming out in April. I loved getting to reconnect with Green over Zoom for this conversation, where we talk about the inspiration for the new album, but also look back at the music and poetry that sparked his creative adventure. It's a Venn diagram of interests where Yeats and Green Day's Trey Cool are in the overlap. But before we delved into those childhood influences, I wanted to start in the present, and it went like this.
Thank you so much, Green, for getting together to do this podcast thing. I do want to start with a very specific question that hopefully takes us to some of those places. And I want to know the lyric, "I love you like a penny loves the pocket of a priest," which is a lyric on a song on Skinty Fia, the new Fontaines DC album. A lyric like that leaps out at me. You know, I wrote it, I repeated it a million times until I could write it down. What do you remember about that line, and when in the process of writing the song it occurred to you?
So that line appears as a sort of alteration. There's two sections in that song there's one section which is repeated in that song. And the second sort of incarnation of that section is when that line that you refer to comes into it. And it's essentially, it's a song that I think I attempted to write a sort of genuine love song about a person. And it was kind of like, lo and behold, of course, it's actually about Ireland, you know. And it's about my currently somewhat complex relationship with Ireland, where I'm living away from it. And I'm looking over the sea and seeing what's happening there. And I'm not really liking it, you know. There's a lot of things that I take great issue with, you know, like the unelected government, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, in the kind of historic, quote unquote, coalition, and the way that they're kind of driving homelessness up, and they're doing things like they're sealing documents which should be open to the public, which are, I mean, everybody knows are hiding the atrocities of the Catholic Church from years back and stuff like that. So anyway, it's just kind of, to use a well-worn expression, to an extent, it's kind of gone to the dogs, you know? And I feel a certain level of guilt, I think, with the fact that I've absconded to London. You know, I'm having a good go at it here, you know? There's opportunity, there's less lockdown, for, you know, one tangible example. Things are a lot more open, generally speaking, COVID aside. And I think that That's added to the complexity of my relationship with Ireland. I feel guilty. I feel guilty for having left it. I feel like I've abandoned it. And the song is kind of like half of it, the first half of it, I see as me kind of talking sadly about how Ireland is recently, you know, and how I've kind of left it and I'm sick of it. And then the second half, I kind of pick myself up and decide that, you know, something has to be done about it, and that I'm not going to kind of rest on my laurels, as it were. So that line, I think that's a line about the kind of my relationship with Ireland is somewhat kind of like, what would be the word, like exploitative. Like, I use it as a raw material in my writing, but I don't actually live there anymore. Don't actually do anything. It's guilty. Do you know what I mean? It's dirty and it's shameful.
Yeah, you want to keep it though. You're holding on to it though.
Exactly, like, I'm coveting it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I that's fascinating. And also it, in addition to the context of it in that song, I'm curious about your process of writing lyrics. How much solitary time are you spending refining to get to a line like that? How far into the development of the concept of the song and knowing what you're saying do you have to be to get to such well-articulated examples like that?
I think the more I do it, the more I become aware of my technique, if there is any, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time, when I say developing, I mean, in reality, it was kind of just me having a couple of pints or walking around catching things in the net, really. You know what I mean? And I roll my eyes often when I hear artists talking about being sort of hit over the head with an idea. But it is how it initially strikes me, usually. I don't like the idea of sitting there with a guitar with no ideas and then trying to slowly mine something. You know what I mean? It's like trying to carve something out of air. There needs to be an initial kind of burst. And that's, in its kind of Platonic conception, it arrives mysterious and vague and full of opportunity. And often there's nothing but a feeling. And that's the kind of slab, you know what I mean, that you need to then kind of sit down and work out, well, what is it? What do I believe exists within this kind of nebulous, vague slab of emotion? It's, I don't know if that sounds really pretentious, but that's how it feels anyway. It kind of arrives initially like that. And then I do love, as an entirely separate process, I do love that kind of refining, the process of refining, you know. It depends on the song as well, you know. Some songs deserve to remain in the impressionistic. And when I feel like they do that, maybe it's pure laziness, but when I feel like they do, then I tend to kind of go with my gut and not really refine too much. But I don't really spend too much time on a line in of itself. Lines themselves arrive to me very easily. That line, "I love you like a penny loves the pocket of a priest," that would have just come to me in one burst when I was writing the lyrics, you know. But it's the process of what really excites me right now in the kind of editing process of it would be, you know, potentially moving one word, you know, just kind of rearranging the structure of a sentence, and then kind of realizing who I am as an orator, you know, and how do I best kind of deliver lines, and what is it about me as a person that can sort of make people listen to what this line is trying to say, do you know what I mean? And it could just be like, could be as simple as, you know, I'm aware that if the way I say a certain word might be particularly kind of plosive or rhythmic, or I say words like how, I think there's a kind of like, with my particular accent and stuff like that, I like the way it sounds when I say how, compared to how other people say how. You know what I mean? So I might leave that word hanging at the end of a sentence, for example, so that it sticks kind of out. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of vowels kind of jutting out, you know what I mean, in a nice kind of uneven way or something like that. Yeah, I love all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, you know, part of what I love about the penny pocket priest thing is the alliteration, because I fucking love me some alliteration. Yeah, it's the kind of thing that three albums in, you know, you're now more familiar with this, what, you know, refining from one album to the next. And yeah, I do want to talk some more about the new LP before we rewind a little bit. So tell me a little bit about this, just like how this group of songs popped off and what you kind of knew you wanted to do going into it. Cause I know it's important to you to explore something different with each one.
Yeah. Well, the songs begin to kind of make an appearance first, really, when we write an album. I think the songs begin to rear their heads in the hour between soundcheck and a show or something like that. And it's those moments that we benefit from to a huge extent as people. When you're kind of touring and you know, you're 3 weeks into a tour and you do start to feel like something that's rolled onto a stage, I think songwriting is a great way of reconnecting with yourself and with your collaborators, you know. The rest of the guys in the band and myself, whenever we kind of write backstage, it feels like we did one tonight for ourselves, you know. And similarly, when we perform new songs that no one's ever heard, that's a moment that we play a song, we play a show because we want to, you know, and it kind of puts us in the kind of ideological driving seat behind the tour for a temporary moment, anyway, you know. And I think with this album, we have all kind of like moved to London. One of us, Digo, our bassist, he's been trying to live in Paris, basically, but we've been there so busy in London that he's kind of gone over there for a week and then we called back, you know, poor guy. But we've all been more or less living in London, and we've experienced this strange sense of we're reminded on a weekly or maybe more than weekly basis that we're different, you know, for the first time, you know, we're othered to an extent. We've had a lot of experience with prejudice for being Irish in London, stereotypes and other kind of thing, and it's been pretty rough, you know. And I've suppressed it, you know, and I didn't think anything of it for a while, you know. It's kind of like, ah, that's crap, you know, they'll learn, you know, people are still learning, and it's not as bad as it was 20 years ago when, you know, you're called Paddy every day and all that kind of stuff. But it is still there, and those experiences informed the album without us realizing it. And it took me 4 months, maybe even after the album was recorded, to realize that's really what the album is informed by heavily, you know. There's even songs in the album that are kind of ostensibly about other things, but it's all through that lens. It's all through that experience, you know.
Yeah, it blows my mind. I feel like kind of naive. It feels like naive to say, like, I can't believe that happens, that in 2021, you know, that you living there in London experience that kind of xenophobia, I suppose, is what it is. And I'm sorry. That just blows my mind.
It's interesting because it often takes form of microaggressions and things like that. Like being asked, you know, often people think that they're complimenting you, you know, like, I guess it's like how women often experience, you know, sexism and misogyny by, you know, men who think that they've got a twinkle in their eye. They think that they're being gallant and flattering. And it's actually, you know, disgusting and unwanted and unwelcome. And, you know, we get asked to tell an Irish story, stuff like that, to strangers, you know. It's just like, I'm trying to have a pint, man. You know what I mean? Tell one of your stupid Irish myths, you know.
People, man, people. So you talked about, admittedly, it feels like kind of a corny thing to talk about this creation moment with music or whatever, the thing where it arrives to you and you're like, oh shit, it kind of feels like that thing that's a little corny to describe. But when in life did you first feel a creative urge hit you?
Well, when I was 9 years old, I had a high bed, you know, which is... which in hindsight actually is kind of just like a bunk bed for a lonely person. It's a bunk bed with the bottom bunk removed. So I could wake up every morning on that high bed and imagine that I had a friend underneath me, and I'd go, are you awake? And no one would respond. And I'd be like, ah, they're still asleep. But there was actually no one there. But anyway, so I had this high bed, and I used to, I got coat hangers, and I hung them kind of from the underside of my bed. And, then I got these cardboard boxes that my ma was about to throw out, you know, and I'd kind of rip them up, or I'd kind of pierce them with the coat hangers and hang them up. And I made a drum kit out of cardboard boxes. And then I got a couple of pans and pots and hung them from coat hangers as well. And I used to sit there and I essentially like would, I went, I was allowed then after like 6 months of that, of learning how to play drums like that, to go to a few drum lessons. And he used to give me this written out homework, and I used to go home and play it, practice it on my pots and pans and my cardboard boxes. And I think it was the fact that I completely imagined that was a drum kit, that was a passable drum kit. And there was a suspension of disbelief. You know, no one could tell me when I was 5 minutes into playing that I wasn't playing drums. Do you know what I mean? Not at all. I didn't exist in a world where that was the reality at all. So I think that was kind of my first flirtation with creativity and music.
And at that age, what would your image of a drummer have been? Or what even, other than the energy, wanting to get the energy out and drums, once you know that's a thing you can hit upon, you know, it feels good. But was there any kind of real world reference of a human who was a drummer that you might have admired or something? And or when did that begin to enter the picture where you're like, drums are music and this is a thing I like?
Yeah, I think some people connect with drums as a melodic instrument, and others kind of hear it strictly as rhythmic. And I think I heard it as a melodic. Like, I loved, so there's Trey Cool out of Green Day. I wanted to be him when I was a kid. You know, I loved the way he was kind of like, he had that persona of being the wacky one in Green Day, you know. And then the drummer of Bad Religion, they had a song, you know, American Jesus. Yeah. So there's a feel that I haven't thought about this in a long time. We used to listen to that. I used to stick that on in the car when I was driving to school every morning. I didn't drive myself to school, but I'd stick it on the car anyway. And there was a feel at the beginning of American Jesus. And there was something so sort of symmetrical about it. And at the same time, it began at the snare and it went to the first tom and then the second rack tom and then the floor tom and then landed on the crash. And it was just, there was this beautiful inevitability about that movement. It reminded me of a dolphin jumping out of the water and creating an arc in the air and then splashing down onto the crash cymbal. It just made sense to me. I think I wanted to know what it felt like to surf that arc, to ride that wave and to create that, be a part of it. And then from then on, I became obsessed with the sort of lexicon of drum fills and all that kind of thing, you know?
So did it become a goal in your lessons once you learned the, my older brother played drums as a kid, so I know about the paradiddles. But once you moved past those lessons and stuff, were you like trying to learn to play that dolphin cymbal thing, or did you start learning to play along with, yeah, the songs you were hearing and liked?
I think that dolphin feel thing was probably the first thing that I learned. I think I probably set up those cardboard boxes just to do specifically that at first. You know what I mean?
I'm doing the dolphin, Ma. Don't come in.
Yeah, I think you know how it is. You know, you get a taste of it then, and then you want to move on. And it was a sort of gateway drug into. And at the same time, my dad would have been getting me into poetry, and I was given a pack of football stickers. I don't know if I told you this before, did I?
No.
So I collected football stickers when I was a kid. You know, just like everyone else did. You know. And bizarrely enough, there was never any trading going on. It was just having them. And then basically you'd stand beside someone else and say, I've got Ronaldo. And then the other person would say, I don't. And then that would be the hit. No one thought to trade in those days, you know.
Just showing off, just for showing off.
Just for showing off, yeah. I always had Ronaldo, but I just left him at home, you know. Wink, wink. Anyway, he was in the garage. So, yeah, my dad, basically, he agreed that he would buy me a pack of football stickers, which were like 60 cents each, you know. And he agreed that he would buy me one for every poem I learned. So I started to learn poems, and I'd learn poem, like kind of really easy poems with loads of rhymes, like Railway Carriage by Robert Louis Stevenson. You know, Ridges Faster Than Ditches, Bridges, Houses, Hedges and Ditches. All that, just the kind of like, It was really simple. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like learn itself, I thought, you know. And then that's how I collected football stickers, and learning things off by heart and then being able to apply them kind of to yourself when you're just walking around or you're in a car or whatever and you're looking out the window, and you can summon something that you've learned off by heart. You can summon it and experience the poem without the page. That was really, that was a bit of a revelation for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that the obviously an awesome parenting thing to do to you know, attach the learning the poem to the thing that you wanted, but also it's so interesting that memorizing and reciting the poem was a phase in the exchange, right? Mm. So you had to learn a poem and then prove to him you'd learned it by saying it out loud from memory.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and then I became aware of the personal utility of poetry through that, because as I was saying, you know, and to this day, being able to summon a line or two that applies, or applying it yourself to your surroundings and what you see and what you hear, and then being able to make sense out of the world and your experience of it in that moment by just remembering something. that's really, you know, you really cracked it then, I think, you know.
Yeah, I'm curious what some of the, you know, at a certain point, it obviously transitioned from being a responsibility to do this so that you could get what you thought you really wanted, the football cards, the stickers. But then obviously you started to feel this, you know, this feeling sparked by it that you're describing where you actually liked it and were up for doing it. What were some of the poems that once you started to get into it, you're like, you know, made you realize that you loved poetry and that you loved doing this thing of retaining the poems as well?
There's a poem called, I'm not sure if this is the first, but this comes to mind. There's a poem called Song of the Happy Shepherd by Yeats. And it was the first poem in a collection of Yeats poems that I had. And it begins with the woods of Arcadia are dead, and over too is their antique joy. Of old, the world on dreaming fed. Grey truth is now her painted toy. And it was one of those things where I think I got it from the first few lines. And then that meant that it's quite a simple poem really, but it never really lost me then. It's a relatively long one. It's like made up of three stanzas. And it never lost me then because I had latched onto the thread from the beginning. And so the world was on mute and I reached the end of it and I resurfaced. And I had experienced that entire poem and held on to the same thread for the whole thing and been, you know, I'd entered it and left. And yeah, I just felt kind of, felt like my soul had been washed, you know. And then I started to, you know, if I ever had a couple of drinks, even a few years later, if I was having a few drinks, I'd start talking emphatically about this poem and trying to get everyone else to apply it to their lives. I mean... It's not, it wasn't even like a pedagogical kind of experience. It was just, you know, if you know this, then next time you experience something, you know, that reminds you of this, you can use this as a framework and it can make sense of it. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, that's what religion is, isn't it? Really, you know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, one aspect of this that is fascinating to me as a fan of your music and the way you will repeat a lyric like it's a mantra is that to me, this sounds like the foundation in a way of that thing, memorizing and repeating to yourself, walking around in your head as one does when one is memorizing, where you say it over and over silently to have that be an appealing way to express yourself lyrically. It makes sense down the line to me, if you see what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. The repetition was always interesting for me as well, because it just kind of, I think I felt ritualistic and shamanistic after a certain amount of repetitions. It felt like you were summoning something. And then, I mean, you are summoning something, you know, and it begins to take on this different form, and you can feel your body begin to listen after a certain amount of repetitions. Do you know what I mean? It also kind of forces people to imagine that there's something, or not necessarily imagine because there might be something there, but imagine that there's something more in that line that they've missed. Like, you know, take another look, you know, and then eventually, and it's kind of like those pictures, you know, those pictures that you see. I think there's a famous one of a beautiful young woman with a candle, and then you look at it more and it becomes like an old haggard woman who's kind of scary, right? It's the same picture and you just see it a different way. It shifts the perspective.
There's a Seinfeld episode about that. That's my religion. I'm always comparing things to Seinfeld. The Two-Face, my fellow Seinfeld fans know that, where Jerry's dating a woman who looks different in different light. And he keeps having to bring her to the table where the lighting's good. Otherwise, it's like, ah! Yeah, I mean, thinking about on the new album, you know, How Cold Love Is, which the title is the line that's repeated. And it does that thing where... Is it getting creepier, or is it just that you're thinking about it more, you know, as a listener, the experience where it starts to feel dirgier or creepier or something, which I do feel like that's another observation about this new album. I feel like there's a bit more of the intensity of like the creepiness or the dirginess, like when you guys go there, particularly on the opening track, which if you could tell me the correct pronunciation of the title of the opening track.
It's called In Our Gríthe Gaojo.
And what does that mean?
So it translates from Irish to English as In Our Hearts Forever. It was intended to be written on the gravestone of a woman from Coventry who died, called Margaret Keane, And basically it was ruled by the Church of England. Someone locally, I think, took issue with it, or the priest in the parish took issue with it and was brought to the church. It was brought to court and brought to the Church of England. And they essentially ruled that it was in danger of being misunderstood or misinterpreted by English people as a terrorist slogan, right? Because of the IRA and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, so they weren't allowed to write in Ar Gcrích a Joe on this woman's gravestone, and it was meant to pay homage to her Irish, you know, heritage. But basically, this didn't happen in the 70s. This happened 2 years ago. So it happens kind of, and then we wrote the album sort of in the wake of it, right? And we were all shocked and hurt, maybe less than 2 years ago, actually.
Jesus.
Yeah, so In Ar Gcrích a Joe is our tribute to that woman and her family. And the mad story is, while we were actually recording that, the two lads who sing the line In Ar Gcrích for the whole thing, which means in our hearts, they went into the barn beside the studio and they were recording that over and over again. And there's basically two parts. Says they record it kind of singing it in a minor way for the first half, and then it changes to a major way for the second half. When they came in after singing the minor one to listen to it, we just got the call saying that the case had been overturned and that she had been basically allowed to put that on her gravestone. So we were all celebrating, and then they went out and had to sing the major part. And Deagle, our bassist who sings it beautifully, said, thank God, you know, that it wasn't overturned before we sang the minor part, you know.
Yeah, the universe knew. Minor's sad, major's happy. Come on, let's keep it consistent. When you know, going back to this earlier time, post making your own drum kit and you're starting to get into poetry and memorizing these poems, when did you start to make your own stuff? Was it poetry or was it songs, and how did those lanes kind of begin to merge?
I had a little notebook with it was like a little hardback notebook where the front and back was kind of made of woven straw. I started writing lyrics in it, and I still have that book. It's really funny. I think I wrote a song when I was really young, and I didn't know how to play guitar, but it was like just really like The Hardest Button to Button by White Stripes. I think the lyrics were just like, it was like a story about like running away from home or something like that. And the chorus was just, and I'm running, and I'm running, and I'm running. And I feel like I've been running ever since I picked up that guitar. You know what I mean? It was prophetic. So yeah, I think I started using the notebook just to write lyrics in. And then I would write down bits of poems that I'd learn for my football cards. And I think sometimes the guitar would just be beyond my reach, and I'd just write lyrics, and then the lyrics became poetry. Yeah, I was curious as to, you know, the relationship between words and music is something that's always interested me, because there's so many great things that you can write that lose all of their effect when put to music. And the opposite can also be true, you know. If you say the words, you know, I love you in the perfect place in a piece of music, it can absolutely knock you over, you know. But if you just write it down on a piece of page without context, it's just completely it's completely impotent, you know. So I was always interested in that. And I like to kind of jump back and forth between those two forms.
And so if you were on the occasions when you were writing a song, because you talk about the guitar being sometimes that reacher. So there did begin to be a period where you would pick up a guitar and start to regard some of these things as songs versus poems. Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was visiting my granny with my parents years ago. So I was probably 10 at this point, and I'd written a song about a kind of scathing song about a gentleman. And I used to hate the idea of gentleman, you know, because I was a proper punk, you know what I mean? And I was chastising this person for wearing a suit and tie and acting like a really nice guy and all this kind of crack, you know? And it was really bad. And I performed it with shaking hands in front of my granny that evening. And it went down a storm, you know? Very receptive audience. I've been looking for that kick ever since.
Yeah, granny was you. It was going to be, you peaked too soon by playing for your granny as your first audience. You know what I mean? Exactly. You're going to have complete 100% saturation of approval. So you mentioned the White Stripes and you had mentioned Bad Religion earlier and Green Day. So was that the kind of thing at that age, at 9, 10, 11, where you're like, you're too young probably to really think anything about like that as a grown up, you might play music, but that was, you know, that was what you thought you were emulating when you played the song about the gentleman?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I think my mom and dad met when they were hippies. Before that, my mom was a bit of a punk and she used to squat in London. And I remember once when she was really young, I think she lived in India for like 4 years and she climbed the Himalayas in her Doc Martens. And that's the mother that I had, you know? So I think that from a very early age, the whole idea of conformity, I suppose, was prevalent. And obviously I've learned to express it maybe a little bit more nuanced now than just slagging a gentleman. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, you were going to say.
No. Once you were old enough to start to have this more defined sense of yourself and defined tastes in music and culture stuff, what did you start to do with your creativity then? I mean, did you have bands just like in school before this and everything?
I did. Yeah. I wore eyeliner and dyed my hair black when I was 14, and I was younger than that. Jesus, no, I was in primary school. It's probably 11, and I played a cover of a Green Day song. What's that Green Day song called again? Hitching a Ride by Green Day, yeah, with a plastic toy shop microphone and amp. So I started to do that, and then I was in bands around that time as well when I was 11 and 12. I kind of made my classmates, you know, join a band with me and sort of like learn how to hit boxes as well. And yeah, so that was my first kind of foray into collaborating, I suppose, you know. But I was probably as authoritarian as I am now.
Shall we explore that some more? What does that mean, Graham?
No, I'm not really. It's kind of in our band, it's the one who has the vision kind of gets blessing from the rest of the band to kind of see it through, you know. It's all in the name of allowing a song to exist as it arrived, you know.
What was your first real band that you really cared about that felt that you thought could do something, maybe?
I was in a band called Gunrunner with a group of lads who were like 4 or 5 years older than me when I was in school. And the singer was a handsome lad and he had a lovely voice. And I was playing drums and we did a lot of covers and we won the local Battle of the Bands a couple of times. So obviously, you know, I thought this is it, like, you know, we won Battle of the Bands on the pier in a small town in Dublin. We had a little Battle of the Bands and we won it, you know, and our name was said through the microphone. Do you think anyone heard that? Do you think anyone from the radio is here? We had one radio interview and my dad recorded it. Him and his mates were at home listening to it live on the radio. And they recorded it on their phones laughing. And he sent it to me then a couple of years ago. And it's just so funny. We all sound so nervous and inarticulate. And I was probably 13, 14. And they were all 16, 17. And it's just so funny, like the undeveloped punk attitude of, you know, we are who we are, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's so funny.
How did being in this position that you're in now, which now you're the guy, now you're the front person and all eyes are on you. We're the ones doing the interview here. You're the spokesperson for your band and all that. So how did you go from being the drummer, which obviously is the thing you had been doing since you were very little, to kind of stepping into this position that is, you know, it's a tough position to be in with your band where you're the one who does all the talking?
Well, when I was in that band, when I was playing drums, I did a lot of backing vocals. And then I would, I'd come to rehearsals with song ideas and I would notice how unhappy I was with how those songs were developed. And I realized that I needed more control, you know what I mean, over how, and I don't think it was necessarily an egotistical pursuit for control. I think it was, you know, I just needed those songs to kind of live in the way that they did in my mind, you know. I need to see and to feel and to play those songs as they existed in my mind to kind of validate my imagination. So I started to take a little bit more of a front seat in that band. And then when that group ended, and I went to college and, you know, jammed with a few different people, I started stepping up to the microphone. I found it very, very strangely easy to sit into that role. You know, we kind of get together and we perform loosely at like a local pub for the fun, for the free pints and stuff like that. And I just couldn't believe how comfortable I felt, you know. I didn't feel nervous at all. I felt really good about not feeling nervous. And I loved, you know, being able to look at people, you know, if it was 10 people in the audience, I really enjoyed being able to sort of like walk off stage and just sort of like look into people's eyes. And that feeling of, I bet I'm the most comfortable person here right now. I kind of like that. And I know it sounds pretty evil, but yeah. And then it just suited me because it meant that I could choose how to write, I could choose the thing that I wrote and then choose how to deliver it, you know. And that meant that my vision was as unobstructed as possible.
Yeah. How do you think that your approach to making music specifically has changed the most since from when you first started figuring out what you wanted to do with it?
I think that I've, to some extent, carved out a place for myself so that I know there are certain chord progressions, I think, like the chord of 4 to the chord of 6, which is used in about 60% of our music. Something about that chord progression just suits my soul. Do you know what I mean? Like Nick Cave has a song, you know, I'm sure, called Your Funeral, My Trial. And the first time I heard that, I went, oh, Nick Cave wrote a song for me. Do you know what I mean? That's how it felt, because it's that chord progression. And that feeling came to me before I realized what chord progression it was. And it's, I don't know what it is about those two chords. You know, it's the same, the beginning of Space Oddity. It's the same chord progression. Fuzzy by Grant Lee Buffalo. All these songs use that chord progression. So I think there's something in that for me. And then also, lyrically, I find it really easy to write something that is at least a little bit sort of interesting to me, because I know who I am to a greater extent. Do you know what I mean? I don't have to kind of sit there and try and assemble these thoughts into something that's interesting. It's like I feel myself being expressed almost immediately now, which is a really healthy place for my creativity to be.
I appreciate what you're saying, because I think sometimes artists can, I don't want to say get hung up on as if it's a bad thing, but just like fixate on this need to do something other than what comes naturally to them, you know, to do something other than what their unique power is. You know, what you're describing sounds to, even just walking around a room knowing you're the most comfortable person there, it's like, it's not evil, it's just your power. That's just, you know what your power is. You're like, oh, I'm feeling my power right now. And the fact that of course obviously translates to fans who appreciate it, but what you're doing is you're like, no, I know it's right because it feels good to me, and I know what that is.
In saying that, you know, musically, you know, I have been getting a lot more experimental, you know. I do hope at some point to do my own music, you know, my own album, as I think most of us in the band do. And I've become really interested in different instruments. Like the other day I went and I bought a melodica and a tin whistle from this local music shop. I came home and realized that the tin whistle is just a really bad one, so I'm blaming my tools there. Maybe just creating different textures, like you know, I'd be a big fan of how Tom Waits does that on albums like Bone Machine. He speaks as well about feeling his hands going to the same places on a piano, which is kind of, you know, just like what I was saying about the chord of 4 to the chord of 6. I really like, I think, for example, drums often seem to anchor a song too much for me. Often when a song comes to me in its kind of vague and abstract form, drums ruin it because they quantize it. And it's much more important for me sometimes to kind of keep the thing that is the rhythm, that is the kind of the binding agent of it, to keep it a lot more like fluid almost. Do you know what I mean? So I don't, it kind of overly solidifies a piece of music sometimes. So yeah, so I've been playing like a lot of accordion, like on the new.
Yeah, what's that? That's there's the song "The Couple Across the Way," right, on the new album. That's just you and accordion, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a, towards the end there is like a, I think it's called a melodeon, like harmonium, really quietly underneath, just to kind of thicken it up a little bit towards the end.
It's one of my favorite tracks.
Thanks. Yeah, it's probably my favorite song on the album.
Yeah, and also I want to ask about Jackie Down the Line, because that's another one of my personal favorites. Tell me just a little bit about where the heck that song came from.
That was that's another song with the chord of 4-6. That was I think we were packing up in the rehearsal room doing a bit of writing for the album, and we were just packing up to leave, and Digo started playing those chords kind of on his guitar. And I think we were jamming something else, and he was talking about making this song, making that chord progression a section in this song. And all of a sudden, the melody came to me, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was kind of like, is that Nirvana? And I was like, no, it's not Nirvana. It's mine. That's brilliant. Like, I mean, and I think I asked everyone to just stay for an extra 5 minutes, just so we can sort of like get like just at the very least, kind of capture some of this in a bottle, so that I can then go home and obsessively listen to like 6 bars of this idea. And you know, knowing that like my excitement will ensure that by tomorrow we'll have close to like a finished tune. Do you know what I mean? Because once that kind of excitement arises in me, that's, I'm kind of dead to the world until it's made. Do you know what I mean? And I won't sleep as well, which is definitely a drawback.
So did you literally just complete that song, you know, go home immediately and work out the rest of that song, essentially?
Yeah, I think the next day we had a 3.5 minute version of it. You know what I mean? You know, there's usually like an extra kind of vetting period where we switch song and then we go back to that other song, and just be ready to say that any of it is useless. Do you know what I mean? And any of it is kind of unnecessary. And I think that this album, we're a lot more sort of austere in what we put into it. I think musically this album is quite simple. We're just kind of we just believe in the parts maybe more than on the other albums. And I think that speaks to our sort of growing maturity and confidence.
What's going to be the single?
Jackie Down the Line is going to be the first single.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm glad you said that.
I'm so excited. I mean, I don't know why, like, there was listening to it, I kept thinking, well, this is a single. I mean, I'm assuming there was probably some debate about this too, because a lot of people have opinions when this thing gets decided, where people are like, is it the most this? Is it the most that? Yeah, I mean, I fucking love that song. I'm excited it's the first one. I guess I would think, like, is it the most Fontainezy song on the album? Or like those kinds of things get... It feels like a little bit of a look of a different approach to what Fontaine's DC could sound like. And that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, me too. I think the only kind of song that I'd be unhappy going out with as a first single would be the kind of song that would be considered very Fontaine's-y.
You right. know what I
mean? Honestly, the lack of risk would probably make me sort of pressed the night before we were to release it. I'd just be like, does it just feel like, I don't know, it's just putting a hand into a warm glove. And also there's no taking anybody anywhere when you release something that they've already, but that they expect. Do you know what I mean? You're kind of, the song's over and they're still in the same place that they were. A first single or a new album, I think it should have the function of when you throw a ball up to a dog to catch, and you kind of, you throw it like a few feet away from them. And they run and they catch it. And all of a sudden, when they've caught it, they realize that they're in a different spot. Do you know what I mean? You have to throw the ball a little bit further away from someone. Then you've taken them somewhere, you know?
Thank you so much for getting together to do this. Such a pleasure to talk with you, and appreciate you taking the time for the LSQ podcast, Ryan.
Yeah, cheers. I enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
Although you'll have to wait another few months before you can hear this amazing new Fontaine's DC album Grian and I have been talking about, you can pre-save or pre-order it over at FontainesDC.com. Skinty Fia is out April 22nd via Partisan Records. And thanks again to Grian. I loved that conversation. And thank you again for listening. That does bring us to the end of episode 71. If you've got feedback or questions, you can reach me on Twitter @JennyLSQ. I'll talk to you next time.